Hassan Salameh, again, is one of the close assistants, one of the key, not only a good friend, but one of the key aides of Haj Amin al-Husseini during World War II. We'll take a look at their post-war association in a couple of minutes. But again, Haj Amin al-Husseini is the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the spiritual leader of all Palestinian Muslims. He also was a major in the SS and a key Third Reich functionary. We're going to read now a short section about a proposed Third Reich military mission, which we're going to see several of the names that we've encountered so far cropping up in the same context. Reading now from a book called The Quest for the Red Prince. It was co-authored by two Israeli authors, both of whom with Mossad connections, Michael Bar-Zohar, Bar-Zohar, and Eitan Haber, Haber, published in hardcover by William Morrow & Company, copyright 1983. Now, the operation that's being described here is a proposed diversionary operation from the Battle of the Bulge, basically. Now, the Battle of the Bulge was the last offensive ever undertaken. That's actually the American name for the Ardennes Offensive, the last offensive operation ever undertaken by the Third Reich. This was an attempt, basically, to force the Western Allies to conclude a separate military peace with Germany, after which it was proposed that they would join together and attack the Soviet Union. At any rate, because very late in the war, the Ardennes Offensive actually began in December of 1944. Because of the highly unfavorable numerical situation which the Nazis faced, they were badly outnumbered, it was proposed that a number of diversionary operations be staged to draw off Allied forces from the proposed offensive. One of these diversionary operations was to be basically a Palestinian uprising, an anti-British, recall that Palestine at this time was a British colony, an anti-British Palestinian uprising featuring largely the pro-Nazi Arabs under the command of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and SS Major who we just looked at a second ago. Now, this operation was to be kicked off by the poisoning of the wells of Tel Aviv, the largest Jewish settlement in Palestine at that time. It was proposed that with the poisoning of the wells of Tel Aviv and the subsequent destruction of tens of thousands of Jews, the Palestinians, given a little bit of encouragement, would openly rise up against the British. This would force the British to transfer large numbers of troops away from the proposed offensive in the Ardennes and down to the Middle East, thereby obviously making the numerical odds considerably more favorable for the Third Reich. Now, this again is a diversionary operation planned for the Battle of the Bulge to siphon off British strength. Interestingly enough, the man that Haj Amin al-Husseini chose to lead the mission, it was unsuccessful, was Hassan Salameh. It's also worth noting that, again, Otto Skorzeny, whose name was going to be mentioned here in connection with another better-known diversionary operation in the Battle of the Bulge, something called Operation Greif, we're going to talk about that in a second. Otto Skorzeny was in charge of all commando training for the Third Reich, so nominally at least, Hassan Salameh, in this particular mission, would have fallen under Skorzeny's jurisdiction. It's unclear whether there was any contact whatsoever between them. There may not have been any, but since Skorzeny was in command of all irregular forces on land, nominally at least, Hassan Salameh, in this commando capacity, was a Skorzeny subordinate. Should also be noted that Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was the, as our author Little John put it, was ministering to the spiritual needs of Soviet Muslims. I suspect that some of that may have been tongue-in-cheek, but it's worth noting that in that capacity, Haj Amin al-Husseini has to invariably have worked with Reinhard Gehlen, the intelligence chief, on the Eastern Front, particularly with regard to recruiting Muslims for SS units. So there must have been considerable wartime contact between Haj Amin al-Husseini and Gehlen, and nominally at least, although there may very well have been no personal contact between them, Hassan Salameh, Haj Amin al-Husseini's lieutenant in the proposed Palestinian uprising as a diversion from the Ardennes, he has to have fallen under the jurisdiction, at least, of Otto Skorzeny. Again, reading from the book The Quest for the Red Prince, and about the proposed diversion from the Battle of the Bulge, the authors write as follows. In the autumn of 1944, Germany's military situation seemed desperate. After the liberation of Paris, Eisenhower's armies had reached the German border west of the Rhine. On the 24th of October, the city of Aachen fell, becoming the first German city to be captured by the Allies. The Russian armies, meanwhile, had reached the Vistula and the plains of East Prussia and were preparing their huge January offensive. Facing the danger of imminent defeat, Hitler desperately sought a way of delaying the onslaught on German national territory. Since the threat from the west seemed nearer, he decided to concentrate his efforts on the Belgian front. In the greatest secrecy, the Führer assembled all the reserves he could raise in Germany for a last-chance gamble, the launching of a surprise attack that would split the U.S. 3rd and 1st Armies and capture the port of Antwerp, thus severing Eisenhower's lifeline. The offensive also included a swift flank attack intended to destroy the British and Canadian armies stretched along the Belgian-Dutch border. If the offensive succeeded and the Western Front was secured, Hitler could turn east to halt the Red Army. To confuse and disrupt the Allied response, Hitler had to use all the aces up his sleeve. One of the stratagems he conceived was to be what later became famous as Operation Greif. 2,000 English-speaking soldiers under the command of the legendary Otto Skorzeny were to dress in American uniforms and infiltrate behind Allied lines. Riding on American tanks and jeeps, they were to sow confusion, ambush dispatch riders, cut telephone wires, misdirect traffic, and blow up ammunition and fuel dumps. Simultaneously, the German high command decided to foment internal trouble in the most vulnerable areas of the British Empire, hence diverting army vigilance and tying down important military forces far away from the European theater. The choice immediately fell on Palestine. In his frequent contacts with the authorities of the Reich, the Mufti had succeeded in convincing his interlocutors that the Palestinian Arabs were deeply frustrated and willing to rebel against the British. All the other neighboring Arab countries were more or less independent, the Mufti pointed out, and their governments were pro-British. The Palestinian Arabs, the only Arab nation to which self-rule and independence were denied, were ready to fight for their freedom. But there was another reason, besides the Mufti's eloquence, which influenced the German High Command's choice of Palestine for their operation. On the 19th of September, 1944, following a long and tedious correspondence between Winston Churchill and Chaim Weizmann, the British government decided to establish a Jewish brigade as part of the British Army. The brigade recruits would be mostly Palestinian Jews. The news threw the Mufti into a terrible rage. Here he was in Germany, having been trying for years to form the nucleus of an Arab Liberation Army, and finally the British were stealing his idea and creating a Jewish brigade. He besieged the German leaders, especially von Ribbentrop and Himmler, demanding an immediate German declaration about the creation of an Arab army. The government of the Reich decided to placate the Mufti and make the announcement of the creation of an Arab brigade on the 2nd of November, the anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. Himmler and von Ribbentrop sent the Mufti letters to that effect, and the high command was instructed to follow up the declaration with a military operation which would prove that the Arab army was already in action.
Continuing with the quest for the Red Prince, the Mufti's long-forgotten project to instigate an Arab uprising in Palestine was hurriedly recovered from the archives, and an operational plan was swiftly concocted. According to the first blueprint, the Luftwaffe was to parachute into the Jordan Valley a group of German agents, most of them born in the tiny German colony in Palestine. They were to be accompanied by several Palestinian chieftains from the close entourage of the Mufti. Once safely landed, they were to set up the first operational bases in Palestine and to make contact with nationalist leaders throughout the country. The Germans would be traveling with false passports established in Jewish names. After the preparatory stage was over and the foundations laid, a second, much larger group of Germans and Arabs would be parachuted into Palestine and would call the population to arms. The revolt would swiftly spread all over the country and overflow to the neighboring Arab nations. A dashing colonel from the notorious Brandenburg Division was dispatched to the Bellevue Palace to brief the Mufti about the plan. Husseini listened to him in silence, an attentive smile painted all over his cherubic face. Finally, he spoke. "I agree with the project," he softly said, "but on one condition." His guest eyed him quizzically. "I want them to poison the wells of Tel Aviv," said the Mufti. While the officer listened to him in astounded silence, the Mufti calmly explained his reasons. That single operation, he pointed out, could guarantee the successful outcome of the revolt. The sudden death of tens of thousands of Jews in Tel Aviv would sow panic all over Palestine. Tel Aviv would be deserted by the surviving population. Thousands would head toward small villages in the countryside, where they would be massacred by the Arab fellaheen. Many others would flee the country by any means possible, throwing Palestine into chaos. On the other hand, the deaths of so many Jews would tremendously impress hundreds of thousands of Palestinian Arabs, who would consequently join the revolt. The German officer stiffly clicked his heels and returned to his superiors. The next morning, he was back at the Bellevue Palace. "I am instructed to inform you," he said to the Mufti, "that the High Command agrees to your project." The Mufti nodded with satisfaction and turned to his aide-de-camp. "Call Hassan Salameh," he ordered. During the following week, Salameh and a few hand-picked Palestinians underwent intensive training at a German commando base. They practiced parachute jumps, the handling of small weapons, and guerrilla tactics. They also underwent a crash course in operating radio transceivers and unconventional communication techniques. They were initiated into the Mufti's secret plan and instructed about the ways to poison the water supply sources of Tel Aviv. Maps and detailed diagrams were drawn up by some of the Palestinian-born Germans who were also to take part in the operation. As the operation's D-Day approached, several trainees were dropped from the 1st Commando. Finally, only two Arabs remained. Hassan Salameh and another former participant in the 1936 Arab Revolt and a native of Jerusalem, Abdul Latif. At the beginning of November, several heavy crates and bags of equipment were loaded aboard a Heinkel 111, which took off for an air base in northern Italy. Aboard were Latif, Salameh, and three German agents. And during the night of the 5th of November, they set off on the final leg of their journey.
So again, Hassan Salameh is the man chosen by SS Major Hajamin al-Husseini, also the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, to lead this abortive... By the way, the mission failed. A number of things went wrong. They weren't able to either poison the wells of Tel Aviv or to establish that uprising. It's interesting to note that Hajamin al-Husseini chose Hassan Salameh, one of his close friends and a key aide, to undertake this mission. And again, as repeated... nominally, at least, Hassan Salameh has to have come under Skorzeny's jurisdiction here, inasmuch as Skorzeny was in charge of all commando training for the Third Reich. There may very well have been no personal contact between them. In fact, probably wasn't, but it's an interesting thing to take note as we pursue the past and the political development of the events and involved with the 1972 Olympics massacre. Again, Hassan Salameh, the father of Ali Hassan Salameh, who is credited with planning the Olympics massacre and who also, within a year, was working with the CIA. After World War II, Hajamin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, retrenched and basically carried his struggle against the Jews and the Jews in Palestine through the termination of the Third Reich and on up into Israel's War of Independence, and where essentially his tactics and his philosophy and so forth remained essentially the same. And Hassan Salameh also jumped with Hajamin al-Husseini from the Third Reich to the I don't know what you'd call it, Arab independence movement. Anyway, the movement for an independent Arab Palestine. Reading again now of the retrenchment by Hajamin al-Husseini as well as Hassan Salameh after World War II and their participation in the fighting immediately following the establishing of the State of Israel. Reading again from the Quest for the Red Prince. It was not until April 6, 1945 in Berlin that the Mufti finally surrendered to reality and admitted that his great design had been shattered to pieces. Germany was beaten, and her final capitulation was a question of weeks, maybe days. Berlin was in ruins, and the Nazis were frantically mobilizing children and old men to defend the shambles of the Reich. That morning, the last supporters of the Mufti, a mere dozen men, were asked to meet him in the Bellevue Palace. For the first time, they saw their leader gloomy and depressed. The frail, soft-spoken Arab knew well that his life was in danger. Neither the Russians nor the Allies would forgive him his crimes if they could only lay their hands on him. He was wanted for inflammatory Nazi propaganda, dispatching German agents behind the Allied lines, active assistance to the Germans in North Africa, recruiting thousands of Muslims in Yugoslavia to the SS units, and persistently lobbying in the Chancellery of the Reich for the extermination of the Jews. He was also accused of planning to establish gas chambers and ovens in the Dotan Valley in Palestine after the Nazi victory. Still, the Nazi victory was nothing but a mirage in which even Husseini did not believe anymore. Gone were the glorious days when he had lived in Berlin like a king, attended and pampered by the Germans as one of their most illustrious guests. Gone were the days when the ministers of the Reich would be the guests of the Mufti at his opulent dinners, where they would gorge on caviar and salmon, rare goose liver, mangoes, and sweet damascene baklava. Today he was alone in his big residence with his last status symbol, a black Mercedes driven by an SS guard. As his close friends gathered in his spacious dining room, the driver walked in carrying Red Cross packages. Each one of the Arabs present was given a package containing tinned food that had been originally packed for prisoners of war. The Mufti then took a thick wad of banknotes from his purse, Swiss francs, U.S. dollars, British gold certificates, and distributed it among his followers. "It's all over for us here," he said calmly. "Each of you must find his own way to get back home. There we shall resume our struggle in different conditions." He rose from his place, bade farewell to his friends, and walked out to his car. Two of his closest assistants were the only ones allowed to escort him. The same day he left Berlin and was driven to Austria. There he boarded a light plane belonging to the Luftwaffe, which flew him into Switzerland. The local authorities, though, refused to grant him political asylum, and he had to proceed to France, where he surrendered to the French gendarme. The French immediately threw the Mufti and his two henchmen into the Paris prison of Cherche Midi. But not for long. It took them only a few days to realize the political asset which this world-renowned Muslim leader could represent for France. He could render important services to the country and help France assert her position in her North African protectorates. On the explicit orders of General de Gaulle, Haj Amin al-Husseini was released from the Cherche Midi jail and confined to a pleasant villa on the outskirts of Paris. The protection of the Mufti was assured by a discreet detail of Secret Service agents.
Continuing with the quest for the Red Prince, even the Nuremberg trials, which started soon after the war, did not change the status of the Mufti. By rights, he should have been in Nuremberg, sharing the box of the accused with his friends of yesterday.
Ted, let me interrupt 1 minute. I forgot. Broadcasting Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Let's take care of that one. I always thought of a chance.
Glad you did that. By rights, he should have been in Nuremberg, sharing the box of the accused with his friends of yesterday. Ribbentrop, Himmler, Goering. Yugoslavia also demanded his extradition for war crimes. But the French wanted to keep him for themselves. The British feared that an extradition demand on their part would trigger a new eruption of anti-British feeling in the Arab countries. The Americans were not interested in the Mufti, even though Jewish leaders in the United States forcefully demanded that Husseini be put on trial for his war crimes. Finally, the Mufti felt that it was time for him to return home. The American Jews were becoming dangerous. During the visit of the new French Prime Minister, Léon Blum, to the U.S., they succeeded in obtaining his promise that the Mufti would be extradited to the occupation forces in Germany. His arrest was delayed, though, by a quick action by Georges Bidault, the right-wing minister of foreign affairs. But the Mufti was told that French soil was becoming too dangerous for him. Husseini had grown used to quick escapes and masquerades. His reddish beard, shaven once again, a false Syrian passport, and a genuine American military travel pass in his pocket, he boarded a TWA aeroplane in Paris on May 29, 1946. The same day he landed in Cairo and was lavishly feted by Farouk, the young king of Egypt. A few days later, Husseini appeared in Lebanon. Palestine was banned for him by the British, and he realized that he could return there only at the head of an army. Now that the World War was over, the battle for Palestine was entering its decisive stage. In his absence, the Supreme Arab Committee had been revived, and the chairman's seat had been reserved for him. He established his headquarters in the pleasant mountain resort of Alai and sent a coded telegram to his faithful followers in Jerusalem. "Papa has returned," the cable said. The time had come for him to, quote, resume his struggle, as he had promised his followers in Berlin on that gloomy April morning. One of the first men he summoned to his villa in Alai was Sheikh Hassan Salameh. They did not talk about the past. They did not discuss the failure of the Arab Brigade, nor the collapse of the project to poison the wells of Tel Aviv and raise the Palestinians in arms. The Mufti sketched in rough outline the main points of his plan. He would create a Palestinian army, which would exterminate the Jews. The projected Jewish state would be defeated, and Palestine would become an Arab state under his own leadership. He promptly appointed Salameh as commander-in-chief of the entire central region of Palestine, including the coastal plain, Jaffa, Ramle, and Lod. He would be second to only one man, Abd el-Qadir el-Husseini, the Mufti's young nephew who had just returned from a long exile in Saudi Arabia. Abd el-Qadir was to be appointed supreme commander of the Arab forces in Palestine as well as commander of the Jerusalem district, where he had fought during the Arab revolt. As for Salameh, he was instructed to return to Palestine immediately and raise an Arab fighting force to prepare for the forthcoming struggle for the possession of the land. Salameh, whose devotion to the Mufti was absolute, did not waste time. Soon he was back in Palestine, surreptitiously moving from one village to another, visiting his former companions from the days of the revolt, enrolling them again in his private army. This time he met no organized opposition to his authority. Many of the chieftains he had known were either dead or too old. Some, like Abd el-Razek, had been granted a government pardon and had left the field clear for a younger, ambitious leader like himself. The anti-Mufti forces, on the other hand, their chiefs wiped out by the bloody massacres of Salameh and his followers, were unable to offer an alternative leadership to the Arabs of Palestine. Salameh quickly succeeded in organizing a nucleus of 400 fighters in his district alone. They were equipped with light arms, partly taken from the caches where they had been concealed in 1939, partly stolen or even brought from British soldiers and bought from British soldiers in Palestine. Salome was confident that his 400-man army would swell to thousands as soon as the fighting started. The traditional method of the faza, the alert, enabled him to enroll masses of fellaheen and city youth for any particular operation. After the battle was over, most had returned to their workshops and villages until the next call to arms. During 1947, Salome prepared for the war against the Jews. In absolute secrecy, he traveled several times to Beirut to purchase additional arms and contact exiled Palestinians. He even had several German officers smuggled across the border and into his district to serve as instructors to his men.
Interrupting, this is before the Skorzenia mission, so don't confuse the German officers being used here on an ad hoc basis with the CIA contingent under Galen that we looked at earlier.
And when the UN Assembly voted for the creation of a Jewish state, Salome was ready and waiting. On the very next day, by ambushing Heller's bus, he fired the first shot in the Battle of Palestine. And thus, dramatically surprising both Arabs and Jews, he came out into the open.
So basically, we have the two key figures that we looked at with regard to the potential uprising in Palestine as a diversionary measure away from the Ardennes offensive, Haj Amin al-Husseini, SS major, spiritual leader of Palestinian Muslims, and his top aide, Hassan Salameh, father of Ali Hassan Salameh, who leads the Olympics massacre and who worked for CIA. We find the two people continuing their struggle, as they put it, from the Third Reich on up to the Israeli War of Independence following the establishment of Israel. Should be noted, too, that Ali Hassan Salameh, the son of Hassan Salameh, later, by the way, Hassan Salameh was assassinated by an Israeli commando unit during the Israeli War of Independence. His son, Ali Hassan Salameh, moved in some of the same kinds of circles and has retained some of the same kinds of contacts as his father. Both of the details I'm about to read you certainly may be apocryphal, but they're worth noting in light of the development of Ali Hassan Salameh, one of the key figures in our story this evening. Again, reading from The Quest for the Red Prince. In 1958, the family returned to Beirut, but the eruption of the first Lebanese civil war made them move to Cairo. Ali continued his studies in Egypt, and after graduation left for Germany, where he studied engineering sporadically in several universities, but mostly he enjoyed life. He developed a taste for expensive, fashionable clothes, black becoming his favorite color. His machismo, his dark, handsome looks, and his natural charm made him irresistible to the young German Fraulein, and in no time he had established a reputation as a womanizer and a playboy. Skipping down. In 1963, he returned to Cairo and meekly submitted to his mother's decision. He was to wed a young woman from whom his family had chosen for him. She was a quiet, plain girl from the al-Husseini family, the family of the Mufti, to whom the Salamés had been devoted all their lives. From his residence in exile in Beirut, the aging Mufti gave his blessing to the wedding. So, Ali Hassan Salameh, the leader of the Olympics massacre, man who works with CIA shortly after leading that foray, the son of Hassan Salameh, Nazi commando, devotee of SS major and Palestinian spiritual leader Haj Amin al-Husseini, marries a woman from al-Husseini's family. Also, interestingly, spent a lot of time in Germany, a place to which he was to return and in which he was to achieve his greatest fame or greatest infamy, depending on how one wants to look at it. And we'll be talking about some of the other people who happened to be president in Munich at the same time when we come back from a break.
Absolutely. There's some very interesting crossings of paths and, in fact, some parallel paths and perhaps some people even walking on each other's paths a little bit. If that sounds bizarre and complicated, you'll see why when we get back and begin to talk about the intersection. We are returned. This is Nip Tuck in the studios with Dave Emery, and you are listening, of course, to Radio Free America. Tonight's broadcast, Terrorism, and two short musical selections while you were up stretching and loosening up those deltoids and those lats and all those things. That was Lou Reed's Berlin and Killing Joke with Almost Red, In Search of the Red Prince. And what we're going to do now is we're going to play a short tape segment from
It's from a Hard Rain show. At this point, I wasn't dating them. They were just numbers in the series. This was part two of a series about the Olympics massacre. This actually occurred
in late 1983, I think, was when this was recorded, the tail end of 1983.
All right, good. And it is going to be, again, covering just the subject matter we were talking about before the break.
Right, we're going to be talking about the Olympics massacre. Now, specifically, the man that's going to be described in a couple of articles here, by the way, research credit for both of those articles, it's not on the tape, goes to Mae Brussel, whose World Watchers program is one of the big three here on KFJC. We'll tell you about that at the end. But there are going to be two articles from the New York Times of March 14th and 19th of 1982, describing a man named Hans Langemann, last name L-A-N-G-E-M-A-N-N. Langemann was a key BND official, a key official of the West German Security Service, which began as the Gehlen Organization on the Eastern Front in World War II, jumped to CIA, NATO, and finally West Germany. Hans Langemann performed a number of different functions for BND, and interestingly enough, in 1972, Hans Langemann was the chief of security for the 1972 Munich Olympics. Now, we took a look at Ali Hassan Salome, the man who led the Olympics massacre at those Olympics, and saw how he became at least as far as we could determine, an anti-terrorist advisor to the CIA within a year after that incident. We're going to take a look at Hans Langemann in a number of interesting contexts. The first two, we're going to take a look at him helping to submerge some damaging information about the Nazi background of former German Chancellor Kurt Kiesinger, and after that, we're going to take a look at his role as the chief of security for the 1972 Olympics. So, this again from a hard rain show at the tail end of 1983. By the way, I guess it's not a problem on this particular broadcast. Some of the later tapes, you'll hear that the tape speed is slightly slower, so my voice sounds a little bit different. When we play some other tapes, just pretend it's somebody else speaking that sounds like me. Okay,
okay, without further ado, the Olympics massacre and related subjects, and a hard rain tape with Dave Emery.
Now, taking a look at the New York Times article about Hans Langemann, it was run once again in the New York Times on March 4th, 1982. It was authored by John Vinoker, last name V-I-N-O-C-U-R. It's headlined, Bonn Investigates Security Official. And it is datelined Bonn, March 3rd. The chief federal prosecutor today ordered an investigation of a West German security officer described by a magazine as having arranged with the Central Intelligence Agency to suppress documents in the United States about the Nazi connections of former Chancellor Kurt George Kiesinger. The official was also said by the magazine to have disclosed that the West German Intelligence Agency sought to recruit, quote, an agent of influence, unquote, to lead President Nixon to think favorably about West Germany. The investigation was ordered into Hans Langemann, L-A-N-G-E-M-A-N-N, a department chief in the Bavarian Interior Ministry. A spokesman for the ministry said Mr. Langemann, who worked for the intelligence agency from 1957 to 1970, was suspended from his post on Tuesday. The federal prosecutor, Kurt Rebmann, last name R-E-B-M-A-N-N, also announced that an inquiry was being conducted to determine if the author of the magazine article, Jürgen Saupe, S-A-U-P-E, had disclosed state secrets. The article, appearing in the leftist magazine Konkret, K-O-N-K-R-E-T, involves eight cases in which Mr. Langemann was said to be involved. The magazine said it had 8 hours of tape recordings containing Mr. Langemann's disclosures. The suspended official's lawyer insisted, however, that parts of the recordings did not originate with Mr. Langemann. The magazine said it was told by Mr. Langemann in 1968 that the intelligence agency sought to stop what it thought would be a series of possible disclosures by journalists of documents from the National Archives in Washington that would have tended to discredit Mr. Kiesinger, who had been a member of the Nazi Party. Kiesinger, make that. I'm confusing him, of course, with Henry Kissinger. With Mr. Kiesinger, who had been a member of the Nazi Party. Mr. Langemann was quoted as saying that he met with Richard Helms, the former head of the CIA in Washington, on February 2nd, 1968, to tell him of the concern felt in Bonn about the documents. According to the account, Mr. Helms directed Mr. Langemann to a man whose name was given as Mr. Hart, H-A-R-T, a CIA employee described as a Nazi expert. Destroying the documents was out of the question, unquote, the magazine said, so another way out was found. If the documents could not be destroyed, finding them in the giant microfilm archives could be made extremely difficult, practically impossible. To do so, it was necessary to take the, quote, Guide to Films of Captured Documents, unquote, out of circulation. This was done. Mr. Langemann was quoted as saying that Mr. Hart turned over 58 volumes of the so-called Guide to German Authorities. The magazine printed a copy of what it said was a telex from the West German Intelligence Agency's resident in Washington, reporting this to Mr. Langemann and suggesting that a special note of thanks be sent to Mr. Hart. And the next and final section of this article covers the fact that Mr. Longman was also in charge by the BND with getting an agent close to then newly elected President Nixon. And apparently the agent selected is described here as an influential San Francisco Republican. The purpose of this mission being to lead President Nixon to influence U.S. policy in such a way as to be favorable to West Germany. Again, of Hans Langemann's attempt to recruit an influential San Francisco Republican as a West German intelligence agent, basically the New York Times of March 4th, 82 writes as follows. The magazine said the agency also arranged to get, quote, an agent of influence, unquote, close to Mr. Nixon. It quoted Mr. Langemann as saying, "We wanted to get close to Nixon, not to get information out of him. Rather, we wanted, that was the sense of the whole operation, to reach Nixon with German points of view from a friend with deep ties and financial relations." Later, the magazine said, information was also sought from the so-called agent, who was described as an influential San Francisco Republican. Mr. Langemann, who headed a section of the Bavarian Interior Ministry with a staff of 220, was said by his lawyer as having sought to stop publication of the account. Well, the second story that appeared concerning Hans Langemann appeared a little more than 2 weeks later and disclosed that he had, in fact, been arrested for disclosure of state secrets, or for leaking secrets. Does not mention whether this was pursuant to the investigation of his deep-sixing of Kiesinger's Nazi connections and his work with trying to get a BND agent close to Nixon, but that certainly seems a reasonable supposition based on the article we just read. Now, the New York Times of March 19th, 1982, the first article was March 4th, New York Times of March 19th, 1982, carried the following story. It's an AP story, datelined Munich, West Germany, and headlined, "Bond Security Aid is Seized After Disclosures on Secrets." The federal police arrested a security official today who reportedly leaked secrets involving President Nixon and Chancellor Kurt George Kiesinger to a leftist news magazine. A spokesman for the prosecutor's office in Karlsruhe said Hans Langemann, a top security official in the Bavarian government and this is the important thing for our purposes here, and the chief of security at the 1972 Munich Olympics, was under police guard in Munich. The spokesman would not say why Mr. Langemann had been arrested, but the official announced 2 weeks ago that it was checking accusations of a security leak. Well, basically, keep in mind, once again, that Hans Langemann was in charge of security for the 1972 Munich Olympics, because he was definitely, up until 1970, officially an agent of the West German Intelligence Service. And at least in that capacity, he worked on behalf of interests which certainly would appear to be pro-Nazi. That is, he obscured the considerable Nazi pedigree of former German Chancellor Kiesinger. So whether this was done out of professional interest or whether this was done out of Nazi sympathies, we can only speculate. And it's worth noting also that Langemann was involved with getting an agent close to President Nixon. Again, what significance that has for our purposes, we can only speculate. But keep in mind that Hans Langemann, the official of what had been Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, basically was in charge of security for the 1972 Olympics.
Okay, so, listening to that segment of Hard Brain, what we have there is a very tangled web, obviously. Significant for our purposes, though, retracing some of the threads we've talked about already, the heavy presence of a German and actually Nazi war criminals, in many cases, in the formation of not only the early Middle Eastern post-war intelligence services like Egypt and Libya, but also, as we talked about earlier, in fact, in the early formation of the Palestinian anti-Israeli groups, and the large part played by Hassan Salameh on behalf of the SS Mufti in the actual beginnings of the war by the Palestinians against the Israelis. Again, directly inspired in many cases by the Mufti's contacts with the SS, and as we talked about later, aided and augmented by the CIA's contracting out for the Galen Agency to arrange for various people like Otto Skorzeny, Heinrich Müller, Adolf Eichmann, and a variety of other wonderful characters to go and help put together the Egyptian and later the Libyan secret services. So we have a strong Germany, and specifically Nazi Germany, to the Middle East tie in terms of the formation of these services. We also talked about Ali Hassan Salame, a man who had contacts with the American CIA and apparently was fairly got along fairly well with the American CIA, to the point that President Carter and Admiral Stansfield Turner had to have a long talk about it when the man died, and Carter considered it to be a kind of upsetting thing. This is interesting, of course, not only because of Ali Hassan Salameh's father, Hassan Salameh, mentioned earlier as being the originator of much of the anti-Israeli activity on behalf of these Palestinian groups, at least the organizer of a catalog, which we didn't have a chance to read you, of bloody attacks against Israelis. But it's also interesting because of Ali Hassan Salameh's involvement in the Munich Massacre, 1972, the death of the Israeli Olympic athletes. Interesting in this regard, and in terms of Ali Hassan Salameh's CIA ties, because of Hans Langemann, a man who we're talking about now, a man who not only is connected right back into the same BND, the Gehlen organization, but himself apparently had contact with groups that had stepped over the fine line between terrorism and counterterrorism, and also a man who apparently was involved in putting an agent of influence into the Nixon White House. So a variety of strange connections beginning to dovetail, and people who would seemingly be worst enemies, namely Hans Langemann, in charge of security of the Olympics, and Ali Hassan Salameh, the man who planned the Olympics massacre, in fact, seem to have a large amount of things in common, not least among them, of course, the Gehlen organization with which we started out the broadcast tonight.
Recall, too, that the first Palestinian terrorist groups put together by the Skorzeny CIA Gehlen contingent in the early 50s.
Indeed. We're going to read now from some segments of Counterspy magazine. This is the edition published March to May in 1983. And the headline is West German Terror Squad, and we're going to find out a little bit more about Mr. Langemann and some of his friends. In the late 1970s, it was recently revealed, West German intelligence had plans to, quote, eliminate and liquidate the leading European cadres of terrorist organizations, unquote. During the same period, intelligence officers were laying the groundwork for establishing their own terror group, which would carry out armed operations as a means to infiltrate the real terror groups, unquote. Now, before I go any farther, let me just remind you, those of you who had a chance to listen to the long series that we did on the assassination attempt on the Pope, in which we got a great deal of depth into the fascist political strategy post-war in Italy. And of course, the keynote for the fascist political strategy of Italy post-war has been the strategy of tension, which is to cause hideous attacks, bombings and terrorist attacks of all kinds, perpetrated by the right, oftentimes in direct collusion with the intelligence services and the military, and then turn around and blame them on the left. Bear this in mind when we're talking about people like Hans Langemann and their plans to start their own, quote, terrorist organizations, who would, as this article puts it, carry out armed operations as a means to infiltrate the, quote, real terror groups, and ask if that's in fact what these people, many of them veterans of the Gehlen organization and probably not real comfortable with democracy, if maybe this is in fact not quite what they had in mind in terms of infiltrating, but in fact were intending to control and to scapegoat. Anyway, going on with the article. These revelations have come to light in West Germany in the course of the Hans Langemann affair. Langemann, a former officer of the Bundesnachrichtendienst, West Germany's CIA, kept meticulous records and copies of secret documents of his activities as an intelligence officer. Some of these documents were obtained and published by the monthly Konkret. Langemann's files do not confirm that the plan to, quote, liquidate the leaders of targeted groups was actually realized. They do indicate, though, that considerable deliberation and work went into starting up a terrorist group. Along with Langemann, the chief strategist for the operation was Hans Kollmar, K-O-L-L-M-A-R, former director of the Bundeskriminalamt, West Germany's FBI, and then head of a private security agency. Langemann's documents show that at least one, quote, potential terrorist was contacted for possible recruitment to Langemann's and Kollmar's terror group. Konkret also raises the possibility that this government-sponsored terror group might indeed have carried out several bombings for which, quote, no known terrorist group took responsibility, and which were never solved by West German police. After a West German TV documentary publicized these intelligence efforts to establish a, quote, terrorist organization, the Department of Justice stepped in. It filed suit, not against Kolmar and Langemann, but against the persons who had provided the Langemann files to the TV program. So one thing that's important about this article is it reinforces the fact that Hans Langemann, the man who was security chief for the Munich Olympics, was not merely involved with this idea to form a terrorist group on behalf of the West German intelligence services, but was in fact, along with Hans Kolmar, the chief strategists. That these two men, in fact, were the chief strategists. So we have Hans Langemann, not a man who was innocently taking notes and reporting on something that he had been merely a cog in the great machine. We're talking to somebody who was driving the machine, and hence, when we speculate later on the possibilities of strange deals and bizarre chicanery at the 1972 Olympics, we are, it is apparent, talking about a man who had planned, who at one time, to form a terrorist group. So the rest of the speculation becomes not quite so strange.
Again, Hans Langemann was the chief of security for the extremely ill-fated, from a security standpoint, 1972 Olympics. Later, we see Hans Langemann working with Hans Kolmar, former chief of the West German Federal Police, and as we're going to look at in a minute, also a guy who was working for BND. We see these two guys working for the Gehlen organization, for the Bundesnachrichtendienst, forming alleged terrorist penetration groups, but as we've seen, what may very well have been agents provocateurs, groups set out to commit terrorist acts in order to justify the reaction against those acts. It's also interesting in light of the fact that obviously Langemann worked for the Gehlen organization, had been involved in what one might term a pro-Nazi capacity on behalf of Kiesinger, as we looked at in the article from March 4th in the New York Times, March 4th of 82. It's also interesting to think that Ali Hassan Salameh, whose roots go back to the Grand Mufti and his father Hassan Salameh, a Third Reich commando at one point, Ali Hassan Salameh, who was the planner of the Olympics massacre, and who was working for CIA shortly after that, was working in an anti-terrorist capacity. So we sort of see the chief terrorist and the chief security official at the 72 Olympics operating in opposite capacities shortly after these two events take place. And as we're going to look at in just a second, the entire operation that Hans Langemann worked on with Hans Kolmar was basically a BND operation. The following research credit for the following story goes to a listener who not only dug this up for us, but also translated it. And specifically, he translated it from the West German news magazine Quick. This is from Quick's issue, that's just like in the English word, Q-U-I-C-K, of the 21st of November, 1985. The article is called The Mysterious Methods of Mr. M, and it's by Rudolf Hajduk, H-A-J-D-U-K. Surely there is hardly a man in Germany about whom so much is written and so little is known as Werner Maus, M-A-U-S-S, 46. Just last week, the private detective made headlines again and even kept the Bundestag busy. He's the man who received 400,000 marks from the BND in order to hunt German terrorists in foreign countries. This amount, so admitted in the Bonn Party contribution trial, German businesses collected and the BND distributed. Maus's career began in 1969. At that time, the head of the Stuttgart BND, Gerhard Folger, who had, among other things, directed agents in East Germany, went to the BKA in Wiesbaden. Besides Maus, he took along with him two more BND colleagues, Walter Scheel and Dr. Hans Kolmar. Maus remained a freelancer. Scheel became commissioner. Kolmar, however, ceased to be on good terms with the criminal director. The lawyer Kolmar found himself, in a roundabout way, a new career with the Kriminalpolizei. He had outstanding contacts in big business, in Hamburg-Mannheim Insurance, and the Fleet Group, among others, and knew quite a lot about intelligence gathering, having established his own security institute, ORG, O-R-G, in 1974. I would interrupt that ORG, interestingly enough, is a nickname for the Gehlen organization. Whether there's anything to that or whether that's just apocryphal, that remains to be seen. Kolmar engaged for his firm 40 old colleagues from the BKA, from the Verfassungsschutz, the internal security, and from the Militarischen Abschirmdienst, the military secret service. In the following years, Maus and Kolmar worked together. Their collaboration was quite dovetailed. Kolmar had the connections, obtaining money, false papers, and driver's licenses. Maus did the work, informing for both the authorities and the underworld. The latest case, acknowledged last week, was directed by the Operations Division of the BND and ran under the codename Cat and Mouse.